G'day and welcome. We're all here to talk about the concept of testing and things that we know we should be doing and how to do it better and smarter. We have three truly uber geeks here to help us on our way. We have Rob, Eric and Peter to tell us all about how we should be doing it rather than how we are doing it. Thank you.
Well, there's one thing before Eric runs off. There's this fantastic quote that I think Eric has to be the one to present. The bulk of the talk, I'm going to stand up and do the talking head for the three of us. But first,
The quote,
yes, it's not in the slides. Oh, okay. It's all from your head.
So, that's on?
Yeah, I can hear it.
I was working at a company where we had this fellow who wasn't real keen on the whole testing concept. And he would write a new module, and then in order to do his ad hoc testing, he would modify the module before that that provides data for module under test, look at memory dumps because it's all embedded stuff, say, okay, yes, that works, and then he'd revert the previous module back to where it was, where that was the correct working thing, and that module would never be tested again. I said, look, we really need to do some more repeatable automated testing on this, and he said, no, that'll only slow me down.
So, he didn't want to do it Eric's way.
That's the quote, yes. I said, I've tried it your way, I know it doesn't work. You need to try it my way.
Okay. So, what really are we talking about? We're talking about some fairly simple things. If you haven't tested it, how do you know it works? If you have tested it but you're not testing it anymore, how do you know it still works? And in the open source world, there's a large number of projects where you know it still works because your users aren't complaining. I'm a user. I hate this. I really want code where when I download it, build it, install it, it works. I want it to work all the time. Everyone, I hope, saw Andrew Tannenbaum's excellent keynote. He talks about lifetime failures of zero. I'll be happy with a daily failure of zero. So tests are there to help users by helping developers create great code. They help you by telling you when you break things, both deliberate breakage as you're rearranging your interfaces and rearranging what you're creating, and accidental breakages. When a bug fix that you put in because user A said, hey, it's not working on my laptop, and all of a sudden you've broken the server environment for the same program. So if you're going to put time into tests and they're not helping you, you're not getting a good return. You're spending time and effort and energy, and it's sapping out your strength. And what we want to do is to try and show you some techniques that can help you get a positive return from the effort you put into tests, not a negative. Now, there are a whole bunch of approaches. Different problems, not in terms of what your code is trying to do, but different testing problems have different approaches to solve them, and they're not all compatible. You can't go out and do everything that we're going to talk about here today in one test and have it work with any chance of sanity. You could try, but don't tell me about it. And, you know, this is a fairly small thing, but once you've written a test, unless you delete the code that's testing, don't ever delete the test. It's there, it's serving a purpose. Rearrange it, make it faster, make it smaller, make it more precise, but don't just delete the test because you've run the test once. And related to this, there's a large amount of automation. And this is really where we get into what good tests are. If you can't understand the code of a test, how can you possibly figure out what it's really trying to test? If you don't know what it's trying to test, you've got almost no hope of maintaining it as your code base changes, keeping it up to date, or even improving it. So tests are still code. They're as important in your code as your actual source code. And you've got to treat them that way. If it's not repeatable, then when the test fails and you find, okay, I've got a defect, and you correct it, you can't tell because you can't repeat it. You can't check that it's still actually going to exercise the same state in your program and go through the same code path and actually trigger the same failure if you hadn't corrected it. if it's not isolated, if if the test depends on other factors outside of what you're trying to test, and a classic example here is when you're testing, for example, parsing an HTTP stream. If your test depends on having an actual web server running on another machine, your test will fail anytime you have a communication problem with that machine. It will fail anytime your sysadmin has gone and decided to do an upgrade. And it's got nothing to do with the actual logic you're trying to test. So you need to isolate the tests to be only affected by the thing you're trying to test. Now, sometimes when you're integrating all of the bits of your program, you are trying to test that all the pieces are joined together correctly. And then it's entirely appropriate that everything should need to be there and working. But most of the time, really ask yourself, what do I need to test the line of code or the function that I'm trying to exercise? And this is related to specificity, to be testing just one single specific thing. If you test three or four things in a single test, logical things. If you're testing that a particular class or a particular object has an internal state, that may be 3 or 4 or 10 or 30 variables. It doesn't matter. That's one conceptual test. But testing that the class has this internal state, and then when you go and run something else, it has a different internal state, that's now testing two things. Two is probably okay, but what about 3, 4, 5, 6? Keep it focused. And the reason to keep it focused is to make it understandable. The more understandable it is, the faster you can look at the test and say, yes or no, that's not what I'm interested in working on at the moment. That's not related to the thing I'm trying to solve. It's not going to help me fix this bug. We use tests to get bug-free software. If a test doesn't help you do the debugging, correct the problem, it's not actually a useful test. Oh, it may fail. But if you have to get out your debugger and single step through several megs of assembly to find the defect, you're not getting as much out of the test as you could. And lastly, a good test will help prevent new defects. It won't catch them all because it can't tell the future, but it will trigger when the preconditions of the test are no longer met. And generally, when you introduce a regression, that's what you're doing. You're breaking some existing previous set of logic. What we've seen a few times is when people have a test project and then they have the thing that's being tested. There's a Linux testing project and there's Linux. Now, this doesn't really make a great deal of sense. The thing you're testing and the test for it are coupled. They're coupled in so many ways. The testing an ABI and an API, that can change. The person who's doing the change to a test, to add a test, is almost certainly the same person that's going to have to go and look at the code to fix it, and vice versa. If you've got a bug you're fixing and you know it's going to change how a test should look like, you need to go to the test. Keep them in the same repository. If you've got some fundamental reason why you can't do that, see if you can change that reason. It really is a very, very important thing. Different languages have different idioms and different manners of structuring your tests. Some put them in directories, some make a bunch of different executables. I think some literate programming environments put the tests and the code in the same single source file. And all of these things are okay, but make it really clear. When someone looks at a function, are they looking at test code? For example, a network emulator. That's not part of your production rollout. Or are they looking at the actual code that's going to be deployed to users' machines and will be going and playing music or mounting disks or whatever? If it's not clear, then it's harder for people who have got a failing test or who are trying to extend the system to know whether they're meeting your conventions. And one way you can make it clear is to actually have a README or a hacking file in your repository. Another way is to have every file document what it is, but don't limit yourself to just one manner. The key thing that I think everyone feels when they see a test and you get 15 or 60 or 100 pages of output is, oh my God, what am I going to do now? I've got all this output and it's not helping me solve the test. So every different environment has things that will help you figure out what's going on. If you've got a network server, for example, during the testing of that network server, or if you're just using the network server during your test, get the log file. Find out what requests were made to it. Get a backtrace. Current variables in the program, how many threads are active. All of these things are easily accessible in most languages. You can even do it in C with a little bit of effort with GDB and a couple of scripts. This lets you take an error output and analyze it, and analyze it really effectively. We'll talk a little bit later about some things you can do to the actual test assertions themselves to help with this, but the infrastructure for your language and for your project is very much worth investing in to improve your ability to diagnose a failure from a test output. And this is important because it's becoming reasonably common now to run tests on multiple different platforms. Mac OS X, Linux, some projects even build on Windows, and you're very likely to get different test failures on these different platforms. So unless you have all of these platforms sitting under your desk, and I don't, you won't be able to reproduce all of these yourself. So you have a choice. You can say to the person who reports the failure, it's your problem, this is open source, you scratch that itch, and I'll wait for you to do my work for me on my project. Or you can make it possible to fix the problem, or to have a pretty good chance of fixing the problem, simply by reading and analyzing the log that's come back to you. But too much information is a problem. So we recommend when you have your test suite running that it should output pretty much nothing, maybe a row of dots or a spinner, you know, 1 out of 1,000, 2 out of 1,000, 3 out of 1,000. No more output than that is actually needed to indicate that it's often doing something it hasn't hung. And only when there are failures should anything be shown on the screen or output to the log file. Part of the reason for this is, as I said, when someone needs to send you something, how much do they send you? Do they send you I have seen this, 100 meg log file of the tests that were run, or the 30K that actually contains the information that matters? If you can't automate your test suite, you can't run it from your build system, you can't run it on remote machines, you can't run it from cron, you can't run it in things like Tinderbox. And they're a fantastic source of information about how tests are failing, because you can set up, for example, a bunch of cheroots with different libraries for different build combinations you've got in your project. You can set up, if you need them, you can set up test machines, all using virtual network interfaces, and have them chat to each other. And we're humans, we're pretty damn bad at doing the same thing again and again and again and again. This is yet another reason to automate. If you don't automate it, you'll get bored of running your tests, and, well, they won't be run. So what you should do is that whenever you build your software, the vast bulk of your tests should run. It should be the default that all your tests are run by the time the software is ready to use. Now, there's a convention these days that you can do make check or make discheck, respectively, that in automate systems this will run your test suite, or try and create a release tarball and then run the test suite from within that. That's good, but it doesn't ensure that it actually runs every single time. And this is where you just small wedge, but mistakes start to happen, things start to slip through the cracks. If you've got a really long test suite, like half an hour or an hour, that in my book, that's a pretty long test suite, you might hesitate about this. But if you provide a mechanism, and I'm being very generic here, just any sort of mechanism, to select some tests to run, then when you're building your software incrementally, as you're doing development, you can reduce the tests to run down to the tests that are likely to break, depending on the area you're working on. And this lets you work past the problem of, well, I'm going to have to wait an hour every time I build my code. It's going to be a very long time for me to do any development. I'm not going to get anything done. No. When someone does it by default, And how many people actually read the install file for software these days? You know? You do? Well, one person.
I'm looking for the one at the top says these are the generic install instructions, then I've got the rest.
Right. So most projects have a generic install installed by AutoConf or AutoMake, I think it is, actually installs it. And, you know, this is good. We've got a standard for building software and installing software. Dot stroke configure, make install. And where in there did your test suite run? This is a foreign machine. You don't know what libraries are there. You don't know what platform it is. And you've got no hope of finding out until the user files a bug that you've actually got a test suite failure. So you're going to have to read the bug, try and take a guess, ask the user, did you run the test suite? They'll say no. Then you go back to them and say, oh, could you please build it again, run the test suite. Make it the default. Really, seriously, make it the default. In GUI programs and web programs, it can be somewhat harder to just run your tests without any interaction. So when I say no human needed here, you can use XVNC to provide an X server to a GUI program. It's not particularly pretty, and you won't see the output, but you can run a large number of tests that way. There are some testing tools being developed by the GNOME and KDE communities that I haven't personally used that allow you to automate GUI tests. And the reason I mention this here is that if you have a human needed to make sure the test passed, for example, in hardware testing, please press the Enter key if you heard this sound. You know, I'd much rather have something I plug into the speaker on my laptop that will actually detect whether the sound came out at the right volume, was clear of interference, and so on. I'm not a very good executor for that test, and also I have to be here to tell if the diagnostic has worked correctly. So this one, I guess, is kind of one of our weaker ones. It's not going to be easy for some projects, and it's not going to be simple, but if you can do it, no human needed. For no special environment, we're thinking of things like requiring a database that has to be set up by a system administrator, or needing a test LAN where you've got five or six machines. Anything you can do in architecture of your project or in test infrastructure to remove these constraints and these requirements makes it easier for people to run the test suite and easier for you to get feedback. Now, there are some things you can do. If you've got a database that you require, and you're not actually using database-specific SQL, if you're using an abstraction layer of, well, nearly any sort, you can probably use SQLite to create a database on the fly. I think MySQL will let non-administrators just drop some files on disk and run it, and you could, in an extreme case, actually run up Postgres in your own directory as your user with a manual config file generated by your test suite. So it's possible. And in all of these things, very first point, we're doing this to create good software, and all the time we spend on the tests is time we're not spending on the code. So you need to get a good return. You need to have a good feel for how much effort you're going to put in doing this for what you're going to get out of it. But given the huge number of results I've seen from projects that do follow this, these guidelines, I guess, is the easiest word, it's really worth putting, I don't know, if I had something that required Postgres, I'd probably be willing to put 2 or 3 days into making the test suite run anywhere without requiring a system user, simply because of the number of people who would then be able to test my code for me. Right, so just had a question from the floor, which was that when you're using systems that can generate a lot of code or have a fairly deep abstraction between the actual stuff that's going to execute and the code that you write, a self-fulfilling prediction can be made, which that it's not going to be possible to test this, and as a result, a lot of code can end up down in that area and untested. So I think there are two things you can do there. One is to take your developers out and find somewhere quiet where no one will hear the gunshots. The other thing you can do, though, is that these things are still testable. It takes more effort to work around the abstractions you've got there if they're not amenable to testing, but you can do that. And you can also set in place a policy. For example, one project I've worked on has a policy that the UI code is not allowed to directly talk to the database. And it's in Python. So we wrote an import hook that when one Python module imports another, gets called. And it says, am I in the UI namespace? Yes. Is what's been imported from the database namespace? Yes. Test failure. Boom. So when we started, we had, I think, 30-odd modules that were going behind the scenes and making it very hard to test efficiently what was going on there. And we wrote down and we said, okay, these ones are allowed to do it, but no one else can. And every time one got fixed, we reduced the list until eventually there were none doing it. And at the same time, that list was output at the end of the test suite every time as a nag that the managers looked at. The actual developers didn't really care. They wanted to get their specific tasks done. But the manager every week would be saying, you know, it's still importing that code. So psychologically, it's a willpower thing to say, we want to go to the effort of doing this. And then think, how can we do this without having to go and spend 6 months setting it up? What can we do incrementally that'll take us down that track? One thing that I've seen, we did a tutorial yesterday, and in that we used the Planet code, which has been renamed Venice. It's a new branch of it, and it's got a lot more tests than the original code, which is a fantastic thing. And one of the tests, while we're putting together the tutorial, looked at how many files were in a subdirectory on disk, and I was cloning this test as part of the tutorial, and I needed to figure out what files I should get in my expected result because I was altering the test. But the error it gave was wanted 14 files, didn't get that. It wasn't quite in English, it just was, you know, number of files not equal to 14. This was useless. I had to put a breakpoint in the test, run the test, then go to disk, and then manually count to be able to see what was going on. We can comprehend text a hell of a lot better than binary, and this is, I know I'm reading what's on the screen there, which is bad presentation technique, but this is really important. You're going to be reading a lot of text. If you have to read binary or stop and interpret what the program's done, you have to go and manually do something that computers are very good at. So when you're writing a test assertion, make the computer do the hard work, the boring work, so that you can just get something nice and usable. So I altered the assertion there, and it now says, got an unexpected number of files. Wanted 12, got 11 from, and then it prints out, one per line, the files that were there. So I can easily tell I got the exact number that was different, and I didn't have to stop the test or put in breakpoints or spend a lot of time mucking around with the system. So I would have got this extra information, even if it had been run out of a batch job on another machine, where there is no way I can go and debug it and analyze it. Another example of that comes to mind is file system ordering. There's a number of tests I've seen that depend on file system ordering. They go, I'm going to create three files called 1, 2, and 3. I'm going to do a directory listing, and I should get back 1, 2, and 3. Now, of course, on an X3 file system with directory indexing on, that comes back depending on the internal hash. So you actually get back 231, for example. So if the test doesn't output the actual value it got back, just says it wasn't equal, then you're not able to debug it. And if you don't have the right file system options on your own machine, not only won't you be able to debug it, you won't be able to reproduce it. Now, this here talks really about text, but it's phrased a little difficult in a less than friendly manner. When you've got object-oriented languages, you can often get the structures to print themselves out as strings. And if you diff two strings, you'll get something that's not necessarily of great sense to a human. But you can do a semantic diff. So if you've got your objects and you write a little routine that will recursively compare them and show you where they're different, You can then take the parts that are different and convert those subsections to strings, giving you a readable diff that is still making use of the object structure to give you the most accurate results. Now, if you're creating new functionality, this test is really aimed at a situation where you're not repairing a defect that someone's come along and said, you know, X doesn't work. You've come along and you've got something new you're adding to your program. If the existing test suite is not all that comprehensive, then you've got a problem. You can't go and create new code and change the existing code to connect it in without a very high chance that you're going to break something. So we don't suggest using this particular approach unless you've got a test suite that can predict against the regressions. If you do have a test suite where you've got confidence, where you'll be able to change what you're doing to match your new needs and tell if you've broken something else, if you've broken the API or if you've broken the expected behavior somewhere else, then this is really simple. You know, write a whole bunch of small tests. Write small tests that match the code that you're, whether you've written the code or not. This is not a talk about TDD. This is simply write small tests first. Because a small test is easier to debug, it doesn't involve a lot of different modules, it's isolated, and you'll very quickly find a whole bunch of little problems, I assure you, almost every single time. When you've done that, then start writing tests that group together different modules in your system or combine them into the larger environment. So, for example, if you've got a UI and database and business logic separation in your program, write the tests for the database first, then write the tests for the business logic, then write the tests for the UI for this, and that way you're aggregating the functionality as you go up. If you don't do this, what happens is that you often sit down and write a use case, or the user wants to be able to click here and have this happen, and then you recurse down. And unless you're fairly disciplined, you end up with one test or two tests right at the top end and several hundred lines of code written down at the bottom end. And this isn't a very good ratio. Fairly established ratio is 1:1 between code and tests. Most languages seem to follow that ratio.
You're talking about the bottom end tests versus top end tests?
So the question is about what the ratio of code to test should be. If you've got 1,000 lines of code and your tests are structured well, avoiding duplication and testing pretty much specific things each, you should be able to get pretty good test coverage with about 1,000 lines of test. This can vary if you write your tests in a different language to your code. You can lower the ratio and get good testing, or you can increase the ratio to get good testing. So there is a certain amount of per project variability. The key thing is that, and we'll come to that in a second, because we've got another technique that talks about isolating modules for testing. So the reverse situation of being able to start at the bottom and work up towards functionality is when you have a very large use case that requires a whole bunch of machinery to make work, or if you've got a large test written by somebody 5 years ago and you may not be entirely sure of what it's doing. You basically want to take an existing complex test and make it smaller. Now, I think I've got more information on the next. I do. So the basic approach is to take the test and clone the entire test. Don't worry about execution time for the moment. Just clone the entire test. In the clone, go down to the end of the first group of assertions, because typically it will do some stuff, and then it will start doing some assertions. Then it will go and do more work. So in the clone, when it starts to do more work, delete from there to the end. Preserve any teardown code. If you have to shut the database down and delete stuff off disk, preserve that, but delete everything else. In the test you cloned from, delete those assertions. They're now preserved in this new test you've made. They're not relevant anymore. And at this point, the beginning of the test you cloned from has now got setup code that's also used in your new test. Remove it. you know, it's a duplicate, find some way of factoring that out, create a helper function. If you do this a couple of times, you usually find that these helper functions look like code that would be useful in your library or program proper, because they're creating an internal state. They may be setting up the database with the right sample data, or they might be just setting up a complex parse tree. But this sort of utility can be very, very useful. It can be useful for testing, but it can also be useful for people who want to work in your domain and do other things you haven't thought of. So as you remove this duplication, as you factor it down to helper functions, ask yourself, would these be useful to my main program, my main library? And if they are, move them out of the test suite. And usually I'd say give them some tests as well. And what this is all focusing about is the state of your test. You're creating a scenario where your test can run. So when you're working through this, think about what's actually involved in creating that scenario. One criticism of this is, you know, it takes Postgres a long time to create a database and insert data into it. So what can you do about that? Well, one thing you can do is you can preload at the beginning of your test suite a number of databases, and you can just say, I'm creating this database, and use it. You can do things like creating the database, comparing it to a known set of created databases, and taking a copy of it if it's not in there, so you have a library of ready-to-use ones, without losing your isolation or your independence from other tests. Okay. On the code side, if you've got a very large code base where nothing's modular at all and you can't actually separate out the different concerns, it can be extremely hard to test. Likewise, if you're dealing with network servers, databases, web servers, they get in the way for most of your code. Business logic or user logic really doesn't care about back-end storage. And the idea of front-end, back-end modules is really related to what the specific bit's about. It's not testing so much. It's good code design. It's a useful thing. Doing it, though, makes it easier to test. If you identify or create, if it doesn't exist, useful modularity in your code, take each external dependency, make an abstraction layer there. It might only be two or three functions long. You know, I want to connect to a web server, read the result from the web server. That's not a huge layer, but that lets you get rid of having a real web server in all of your tests, except maybe a couple of integration ones. And it depends on the individual project how important it is to have real-world scenarios as part of your integration tests. When you do this, though, you've got to make sure that your test modules, when you replace this module during testing, and the actual module keep the same interface. Because if they vary, then you're no longer actually testing to the code that will be used in production. So you need to test each module explicitly in isolation on its own. If you have something that connects to a web server, you need to go to the effort of having a simulated web server, a TCP connection it can make, and check that it really works. Once you've done that, for the tests that depend upon this layer, the tests that need to connect to web servers, the tests that need to connect to databases, they can use the replacement test-only modules. So going back to my much earlier example of using SQLite, SQLite can run in memory. It's extremely fast. You don't need any disk resources. You don't need to clean up from disk. And all you need to do to substitute that in, if your database abstraction layer allows it, is to give a different URL to the database at the beginning of the test. Incredibly simple and incredibly useful. You often need to provide hooks in your code to select the module to be used. So, for example, the URI for the database needs to be parameterizable. You need to have some way of selecting that. If you're in a C program, one easy way of doing this is to have a different O file for each implementation of the interface. The real-world one, the test one. And you might have several different test ones for different scenarios. In C++ and object-oriented languages, it can be a lot easier. You can have an interface, a virtual pointer, abstract-based class that you use, and just subclass that for your test, create one that does what you need for the test, and use that instead. Substitutability is tricky. It's very hard to tell that a pretend database is going to behave the same way as a real database. So what can you do about that? You can test for substitutability at a number of different degrees, and it's going to depend on what you're testing, how easy it will be. The least desirable one is to manually test, to simply have a note in your code that says, if you change this interface, you must test these things by hand, and bring them up and connect to them as a database, and okay, it looks good, or I'm getting the results I expected. Another step up from that is to have a very small self-validating thing, like, yes, I can connect to this. I don't know if I'll get the useful things out of it, but I can connect to it using this API. And then have your test suite automatically use that API against all of the different implementations. That way, if someone changes the API on one of them, the test will break. The most advanced one is to have a fully self-verifying test that you can run against each implementation. So it will do things like, with a database, I should be able to create tables, insert data into the tables, perform these queries, create these indexes, all the features you use, and then run across the different implementations. If you have a database abstraction layer, though, and you're stubbing out the database by using SQLite as a common example, then you probably don't need to do this because it's the responsibility of the abstraction layer to do it. So always remember that you don't need to test something if you're just using someone else's code. Only test it if you're testing code you're writing or creating the glue for. Now, placeholder result. When you've got a situation where it's hard for you to create the expected outcome of a test, the concrete syntax tree for a language parsing a 1,000-line document is not a simple thing. It's not easy to create by hand. So, a placeholder result, set your expected result to something that's wrong. Set it to a null pointer. Set it to a string that says, I am not a valid answer. Run the test with your code there and inspect the result that comes out. You should be able to validate if it's the right result, if it's been formatted in an easy-to-read manner, which was the very first technique I talked about. Make it readable. So if you combine these two, you can very quickly create tests that test very complex data structures and are quite robust without having to, by hand, bench through a huge amount of code. People often do a lot of these things ad hoc, so I know before this one actually got pointed out to me as a sort of formal mechanism, is I would run up the program in a debugger, and then I would take out a copy of the structure and write down all the fields I needed into a static initializer for the language I was using, and then I'd copy that back in. If you get your diff program your analysis program to be able to output a simple string, you can simply take, yes, that's right, drop that in, and do the test as a string at the very end. And it saves a huge amount of time. So this is just the beginning. We're hoping that we can get all of you folk and more people over time talking about specific ways of working on tests. The same way we've been talking now for a couple of decades about ways of writing code, we need to lift our bar and start talking about tests. So it's an ongoing effort, and we're going to hopefully have a wiki and mailing list up, and we'll send information about that to the attendees list once we've done it. Do you guys want to come up and we'll take any questions?
I think one thing we'd like...
The questions come from there.
Yes, and just... who's aware of the Patterns book for object-oriented programming? One of the things we'd like to do is... The way the Patterns book formalized a lot of object-oriented methodology, we'd like this testing paper to be the start of a similar thing for testing methodology, so that we have common terminology, and I can talk about placeholder result and any of you will immediately know what I'm talking about. So we will go straight on to questions. I'll bring the mic.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add something that maybe you didn't have in that was the idea of both continuous integration and continuous agitation. So I don't know if you've seen the Erlang and Haskell quick check systems. I mean, that's just a really nice way of generating lots of tests fast. So
there's one thing, I guess, that it's a bit disappointing about the time we've got, is we've got twice as many patterns we've already documented, and they're in the paper that we'll be sending out the information to the organisers. Will be on the CD-ROM. And once we get this wiki up, it'll all be up there as well. So we talk about using random data, and random permutation is a form of random data in the context of tests. Continuous integration is a different concept. That's the concept where you're continually taking the work someone did that day, whether they're really finished or not, and putting it into the main line, letting your test suite run. And that's, I think, covered. The core of it is covered by having your default build run your tests, because that means you don't have a situation where things aren't being tested for any length of time.
Just one thing I've found. Sometimes it's worthwhile doing tests on databases within a transaction. So you add some data, check that the data's there, I guess, and roll back the transaction. It's just a tip.
Right. So, yeah, that can be a way of increasing the performance of a single test, except when the transaction fails to roll back properly and your next test is then in the old transaction and you're screwed. So isolation really, I think, is a much more important consideration than speed. You can optimize for speed in a number of different ways. As long as your framework considers a fail in the isolation layer something to rebuild the test database so that you do still get full isolation, then that's a fine technique to use.
I think, too, one of the things that happened...
Louder.
With Robert and Eric and myself coming together, we all three have very different backgrounds, and yet we found huge amounts of commonality. But one theme that ran through it again and again and again was test isolation trumps performance. Test isolation trumps factoring out common data. You've really got to have test isolation if you're going to have a meaningful test regime without having a fragile test regime that goes stale and breaks.
You are...
Is this on?
Yes.
You mentioned that there was a paper.
Yep.
Is that available now? Do you have a URL?
Minutes. Several minutes.
Several minutes. And
yeah. We'll send an email with where we put it to the list, the attendees list.
Just a quick follow-up to what Paul just asked. Just merely looking over the shoulder of these fellows, I saw these guys working on a real honest-to-God paper. And if even a quarter of their knowledge ends up written down there, this will be something to read. And, you know, Linux conferences tend to be a bit slack about papers, but I'm really looking forward to reading this one. So cheers, guys.
Hey, there's another one over here, Eric, to the right.
So do you look at any of ways for, you know, talk about test isolation, repetition, but what about for, like, emulating devices? So you can do device driver testing, low-level testing.
I've got a hardware background.
I recently worked on a project which delivered 70,000 lines of C++ code and delivered 80,000 lines of test suite. We did full emulation of the hardware. We could execute all the way to the bottom of our C++ device drivers using this emulation technique. And we ran the entire test suite before we downloaded the stuff into the hardware. We didn't have the advantage of full control over the hardware input, so we couldn't automate the in-hardware testing. But it saved our ass about 80,000 times. It can be done. It's a selection of techniques that go together. We haven't documented in the paper so far because there's finite time and only three of us.
But I will note that the technique of dividing and conquering the code and going for modularity, things you can substitute in, is really where that comes from. It's a matter of how you specifically achieve that in the kernel you're working on. How can you tell that your software device driver matches the hardware one? That substitutability.
But the trick is you can do spectacular amounts of testing on your build host first without doing it in your embedded host, almost always.
Yeah.
You can stub in operating system things, or you can write operating system interfaces that you can abstract. You can play these games and do huge amounts of embedded testing without it being embedded first, assuming you trust your compiler. We had some compiler bugs we found that way.
Any other questions?
I think Ken's calling a timeout here on.
Thank you, guys. That, as always, has been a brilliant talk. Thank you.